The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it to start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And we have an interesting program, a great book to talk to you about, and we're going to get right to it. One quick announcement. We're on the 60-minute format, so please do watch the clock if you need to get a hold of us, want to talk to our guest, and we hope you do, or send us an email. Make sure you do it while we're still going on, and this will be the 60-minute format program. Our toll-free number for today is 866-687-7223. No call screeners. Please be patient. Wait, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Remember, this is a talk show, so we do like to talk, and we encourage you to use the toll-free line. And again, 866-687-7223. You can still use email. That also works fine. Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments and questions on our blog. And to do that, go to thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. Scroll all the way down. That, by the way, is our archive summary page. And you'll see comments and questions down below. As soon as you post your comment or question, I will get a copy of it and can bring it up for our guest today. Remember, all that we're doing is archived. Check the upper left menu, and I want to draw your attention to the fact that there's instructions there for listen live like we're doing now, podcasting, and compressed MP3s as archives on our website. Let me know by email if you have any questions. And then don't forget, we do have a store. You get there by clicking on any of the Pepper listening to the Space Show pictures, and she will take you to our LogoWare Cafe Press store if you are interested. Please don't forget, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do financially support us. We are listener-supported radio, and if you're a federal taxpayer, you get a deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. There is a large PayPal banner at the top of our homepage and other website pages. That's the easiest way to support us. But you can also use a check made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And we certainly do appreciate your support. If you have any questions about our parent or supporting us, do let me know. And then don't forget, we do still have sponsors, and they get the banner ad going across our homepage, which you can change as often as you want. And since this is a 60-minute format show, I just want to shout out and thank our great sponsors. We would not be doing the program without their help: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. And click on their banners, see what's underneath them. They change that content from time to time. And again, without those great sponsors, we would not be doing our program. I'm very happy to bring back to the show Dr. Lou Friedman. He is the co-founder, was the co-founder with Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray of the Planetary Society. He retired from both the Planetary Society Executive Director, where he served for about 30 years, and he retired also from the Board of Directors around 2014. He has his bachelor's degree in applied math and engineering, and then he has an engineering mechanics master's degree and a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT. He's been involved in a lot of missions and planning during his career and programs for NASA, JPL, as well as for the Planetary Society. His full bio is on the website, and I urge you to read about it. But Lou has written a new book, and it's available, and it's a book I believe that all of you are going to want to read. It's about his experiences. It's called Planetary Adventures from Moscow to Mars, and this is why he's back on the show with us today. Lou, congratulations for your new book, and it's good to talk to you again and introduce us to your book and what you're doing now that you're retired from the Planetary Society.
Well, thank you very much. I'm enjoying my retirement. I got to say, I'm not enjoying it as much as I did when I was working, but I am enjoying it very much. And the society is doing well, so I'm very happy with what we created there. But I have written a couple of books since I have retired, and wrote one a couple of years ago called Human Spaceflight The Future of Human Spaceflight. Now I'm doing. I did this new one on planetary adventures, mostly about my experiences working with the Russians in behalf of planetary exploration in the 80s and 90s in the last century.
Let's focus for the time being on your new book, Planetary Adventures. Of all of your experiences, and you did a lot of things with the Russians over the years, what would stand out? Is there like a number one experience that you ever had with them? And I guess doing things with the Russians today is very different than the 80s and the 90s.
Well, it is very different. What I'm sure many of your listeners don't even know, because it was so long ago, but in the 80s, when we started the Planetary Society, Russia had a very active, the Soviet Union, of course, at that time, had a very active space program. They were doing missions to Venus. They did a mission to Halley's Comet. They were planning missions to Mars and even the Mars satellite Phobos. They had a space station up there, the Soyuz space station. The United States had none of these things. The United States had basically decided not to do planetary exploration in the 80s. They didn't approve any missions. And so after Viking and Voyager, the United States was sort of concentrating only on building the shuttle, which took more than a decade. And so we had a very almost moribund space program of exploration, whereas the Russians had a very active one. And one of the purposes we had at the Planetary Society was to keep the whole international community, the American scientists, involved. And so we began great emphasis on international cooperation. And so many of the activities we did with the Russians were in pursuit of joint missions or collaborative missions. And I would say the outstanding one was basically our long-term effort to explore Mars together, develop the concept of Mars rovers, which was not even a concept in the American program at that time, and begin promoting rovers for the surface exploration of Mars. We did a number of very interesting tests in Kamchatka, on volcanic regions, in Death Valley in the United States, and even in Pasadena, where we, and even on the beach in Santa Monica. We did a number of rover tests with Russian-developed rovers, trying to stimulate the American program into accepting rovers, which they, of course, finally did in the 1990s.
What caused them to finally accept rovers in the 1990s? Was it competition with the Soviets, your work? What do you think was the trigger for that?
Well, it's funny. The scientists had this initial attitude with rovers. Oh, no, those are just a stunt. They don't do anything. They take up valuable real estate, valuable payload from the instruments we want to send to Mars. They didn't kind of get the idea of exploring. And it took a while to convince the science community. I think our activities had a lot to do with it. It wasn't the only thing, of course. And there were some wonderful people at NASA who developed it. I have to shout out to both the administrator, Dan Golden, and the associate administrator, Wes Huntress. When they took over, basically, in 1990, and right after that, the whole attitude toward Mars exploration and planetary exploration changed from the 80s. And so I think in part it was stimulated by our public events, but and promotion and highly visible testing of the concept. But in part, it was also just the realization that the U.S. program was not doing a lot, and it was time to do more.
Did the end, sort of the end of the Cold War, the fall of the wall, did that play a part in space exploration in the U.S.?
Well, the end of the Cold War had two major effects, and I talk about this in the book. I think one of the most remarkable things for all of us who were brought up in that time period was communism ended, and yet communism was a dominant force in all geopolitical thinking, in our public newspapers every day for decades, so all through the 20th century. And then it just ended, and it was kind of like, it didn't end with a bang, it ended with a whimper, and it kind of dissolved, and the Soviet Union dissolved. But the last 5 years of the Soviet Union under President Gorbachev, there was this perestroika, this emphasis at reform, realizing that their own country was decaying, and an effort to try and stimulate international cooperation. That helped. It helped us a lot because the attitude toward international cooperation in the earlier part of the decade was very negative, and then in the latter part of the decade it became positive, and it became positive in the United States, too, as our administration recognized that there was willingness to do international projects and to be open about more openness in the Soviet society. So I think that played one part. Then, of course, when the Soviet Union ended, basically their economy went into shambles, and they had an enormously difficult transition, and that basically ended their leadership in space. That ended all their major efforts. Their space station, of course, became focused. Fortunately, they kept their capabilities and became part of the International Space Station, which was very important to its development and probably saved the space station after our losses in the shuttle program. And in planetary exploration, however, they lost the Mars 96 mission with a launch failure. They lost several of their projects were delayed. They lost their Phobos mission on bad programming, didn't get into orbit successfully at Mars, but then it stopped working prematurely. And then later on in the, they lost a Phobos sample return mission also on launch. So they have had basically failures in the planetary program ever since the end of the Soviet Union, which is a loss, of course, but at least at this point, the American program and European program and others now are back in business.
You already have an email. Our first one is from listener Todd in San Diego, and he says, Lou, I've not yet gotten your book, but it sounds like a great read and a terrific history read. I'm wondering, was there any concept back in the 80s or 90s that either the Planetary Society had or the Soviet Union or the U.S. that maybe someday there might be private sector involvement like we have today, or even leading up to today, coming out of Russia or the United States, or was it still under the table or just non-existent?
Well, two answers to that question. One is, and I talk about this a lot in the book, one is, of course, that the government program is what explores the planets. There's no real private program that is likely to explore the planets. I know Elon Musk has a great ambition to explore Mars, but he's even focused on the rocket part of it right now. That may happen in the future, but it's always may happen in the future. It's really been government exploration, and that was our focus. But by the same token, the Planetary Society itself was a privately funded organization, no government support whatsoever, and we did build payloads that went to Mars, and we did build vehicles that helped test the rovers, and ultimately, of course, we built the Solar Sail mission, which is now flown successfully in LightSail. So, in a sense, we were presaging private exploration. And the difference is, however, so much of private exploration now is talked about for commercial reasons, people who think they can make money in space by various approaches. We didn't have the goal of making money in space. We had the goal of stimulating more and more exploration, and it was really for Elio Massoneri or charitable purposes, or just because these are great projects that had great science and cultural benefits. So we didn't have a commercial goal, and those are, so that's the distinguishing factor between what we were doing in the 80s and 90s and I think what some of the talk now is about private missions in space.
What about the Soviet Union? Was there even a private segment that could have done missions like the Planetary Society, or not even thinkable back then?
Well, it was not thinkable back then, although in the transition period, as they gave up on communism and started transitioning to capitalism, they did come up with approaches that would try to at least have private initiatives and maybe even make some money. And they of course, made an effort to convert their ballistic missile fleet to private launch vehicles. And in fact, that's what the Planetary Society launched its first solar sail attempt on. They didn't have real success with that. And there's a chapter in the book about the launch of Cosmos One, which actually I'm a little really didn't succeed, and I think it was for not good reasons. But the they were making some private efforts, and they certainly came to us with the suggestion of the Cosmos One solar sail, which was built all with private money, cooperatively. The money came from U.S. interests and our members and our donors, but it also was a private initiative without government activity in the Soviet Union, except to the extent that they did use the government facilities for that support.
Do you think that during this period of time, it wasn't always easy to do things with the Soviet Union and with Russia? Did that start to ease up through your activities after the Cold War, or how much trouble was it? How much red tape did you have to go through to do missions with the Soviet Union and then with Russia?
Right. Well, it was difficult at first, and we had to learn a lot. However, even in the Reagan administration, when relations were rather hostile between the evil empire, as Reagan called it, and the United States consideration that Andropov and Brezhnev were the way they were acting in post the Afghanistan war that they were conducting, it began to get cooperative rather quickly. We got good cooperation from the Department of Commerce, Department of State. NASA was never an enthusiastic backer of what we were doing in the 1980s, but they were taking their cues from other parts of the government, and so but I think we got enough cooperation so that I emphasize this. It's really important to know, because we exported a lot of things. We brought computers over there. We conducted activities. Everything we did was legal. We got export control licenses on everything we did. We even took a trip, a remarkable trip, which is in the book, about us going to their secret nuclear bomb-making site in Chelyabinsk 70. I went with Edward Teller, of all people, the father of the hydrogen bomb. But it was in a spirit of cooperation, because at that point the attention was giving not toward mutually annihilating each other, but worried about protecting the Earth from dangerous, potentially hazardous asteroids. And they wanted to work on that, and our scientists wanted to work on that. So I have a chapter on that in the book. So, a lot of things did have to be worked out. There was both red tape on the Russian side and red tape on the American side. But In general, we got cooperation with all the authorities just by pushing our way through. We were a private organization. We didn't have to sort of go along with the government concerns at the time. We just had to obey the law.
Another email, and listeners, let me remind you, our telephone line is available if you want to use that. 1-866-687-7223. Cheryl is in Denver, and she says, I assume your book covers the International Space Station and our partnership with the Soviet Union, Russia on that. What do you recall about that? What was the Planetary Association's position with the International Space Station? Did you help it come about? Tell us about your experiences with it, please.
Well, it's interesting. I do have some discussion of that in the book. The International Space Station was not a big part of the Planetary Society's agenda. We had testified in the 1980s that, not that we were opposed to it, but we wanted one that was worth the cost that led someplace. But it's interesting that if you look at what's gone on in the human space program, all initiatives that have resulted in anything, which is really only two, were done for geopolitical reasons. They weren't done because of space interests at all. First of all, there was the Kennedy and the decision to do the Apollo mission and the race to the Soviets to the moon. Kennedy wasn't interested in space at all. And the space station was proposed in the Reagan administration, but it didn't go anywhere until the Clinton administration took it on, not because they were interested in the space station or space as per se, but because they were looking for a way to engage the post-Soviet Russian military-industrial complex and send money there for work that would keep them out of doing more nefarious things with their considerable missile capability. So the initiatives are really done for geopolitical reasons. Planetary Society, I did get to play a part in just one trip. I went to Russia, I guess, when the space station agreement was being negotiated. And I remember writing down in my notes saying, this is going to work. Those people are just as arrogant as our people in the human space program. Our guys at Johnson, the engineers, they thought they know everything, and their people over in Russia thought they knew everything. And I said, they're going to find a way of making it work, and they did. And I actually say in the book that I think the International Space Station deserves a Nobel Peace Prize because it has worked in a remarkable way through several different regimes, starting with communist and then moving to the post-Soviet era, through Yeltsin and now through Putin and all the tense relationships that have come back again, and they helped an enormous amount when our shuttle accidents occurred, and they've accomplished a lot that they would not have otherwise accomplished except for the United States taking the lead on developing the International Space Station, and they brought in Europe and Japan and Canada and many, and I guess 14 other countries. So I think it's a remarkable international achievement. I'm not sure it's a remarkable space achievement. I'm about exploring other worlds, and they're not exploring other worlds. But no matter, it's doing good, and it certainly is a great technical accomplishment.
I have another email question for you from Joe in Tucson. And he says, Lou, you've mentioned several times that space was done for geopolitical reasons. Also, governments were doing space. And today we hear how the commercial sector is growing and coming up with all sorts of new revenue and new opportunities, mostly, I believe, with small satellites. Has anything fundamentally changed? Is there, in your opinion, a real commercial opportunity in space? Are the priorities still geopolitical with human spaceflight? What are your opinions, given all of your experience going forward today with what is called new space, private space, all of what gets a lot of headlines, but we still seem to be short of action and short of revenues other than the government being the customer?
Well, I like the spirit of that question, and I will give my opinion, but I emphasize it's my opinion. I could be wrong. We're still looking for some commercial benefit from space. We found, of course, many in the communication satellites and in remote sensing satellites and in other kinds of specific data related to Earth studies. For the most part, or even maybe space weather will turn out to be commercially viable selling of data. But for human spaceflight, no one, I think, has identified a commercially attractive way or a commercial return that one could get, at least in a lifetime or two, maybe in centuries there will be a return. But so I don't see commercial on human spaceflight at all. And I think many of the proposals, even in the current lunar program and ideas of asteroid mining, I like the research that's going on. I think that that's all interesting, but it's a long, long way. I can't think of a more expensive way to try to get water than to mine it on the moon or on an asteroid. We haven't even done very well in getting it out of the Antarctic to other regions on Earth. So I'm skeptical about the commercial viability of some of these proposals. But I could be wrong. And so I emphasize, I think, that we can't give up on the government program. Every time somebody says, get the government out of the way and let the private sector do it, what happens is nothing gets done. That happened in lunar exploration. For almost 15 years, there was no lunar missions because there was this argument to get the private sector out of the way. There was this argument that we didn't need to do a mission to Halley's Comet because the private sector would make money by making movies from the mission. Well, that means we didn't do a mission to Halley's Comet. So I've been victimized many times by ideas that, and of course the asteroid missions that are going on now, there's quite a few of them, but they're all government, they're NASA missions. There are some efforts that are privately funded things. I wish them well. The research, but there's a long road between the research and whether or not they'll actually turn out to be commercially viable.
Is the Artemis the right way to return to the moon?
Well, now you're hitting on even a more controversial question for myself.
Of course.
I'm not enthusiastic about the Artemis program. First of all, return to the moon, I'm not even sure I see much of a point of it for humans. That's something we did, well, now 40, 50 years ago, and I don't know why we would want to enter another space race, this time with China. We might lose this one. We won that one, and we should be building on it instead of trying to recreate it. And now, China will go there in a couple of years. Europe may even go there in a few years, and those are good. Those are what new nations should be doing on their first attempts to get humans first to Earth orbit and then to the moon. But we should be looking beyond that, and I think we have ideas that would be much more, would take our program much further. Us returning to the moon, I really see it as a possible sink or detour. We'll get stuck trying to do that for decades and not accomplish much more than we did, as I say, 40 or 50 years ago. So I'm not enthusiastic about it. It's not negative. There's nothing there. Whatever they do will be, I'm sure, a great technical accomplishment in the long run. But it's not the way I would proceed for exploration itself.
Does human spaceflight to Mars therefore go up in importance to you? Should we be pursuing how to do that, or should we just leave it to Musk?
Well, I think we should pursue it. I think, first of all, it's a great government enterprise that should involve many nations. It could be like the International Space Station was a couple of decades ago, bringing nations together. There'd be so much excitement and public interest in the result of it. There's many aspects to it, not just the engineering ones, the scientific ones, the cultural ones, the life sciences interest. There are many things that I think would drive. I don't know that. So I would make it a long-term international goal. But of course, that is driven by the politics and the finances of things, and so it depends on forces that are greater than just space program decisions.
Listeners, Let me give out our phone numbers again. 1-866-687-7223 and email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Public-private partnerships, and they got their start when you were still at the Planetary Society. They seem to have really kicked into full gear now and seem to be the way of doing things. What are your thoughts on public-private partnerships? And I guess they're mostly a feature of the United States, but what do you think? I mean, they seem to be really desirable for a lot of the new space sort of struggling commercial space companies. They want to do a PPP with NASA.
Yeah, I think they are very desirable. I think, we started in that role. Everything the Planetary Society did, we tried to do as a public-private partnership. We did our private funding, but we worked with NASA. We worked, as I said, with the Russian Space Program. We worked with the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agencies, and the individual countries. So public-private partnerships, I think, are great because they harness more resources, they harness more interest, and they broaden the goals for more objective. You can accomplish more, maybe even with less expenditure in some cases, or the same expenditures. So I think it is a great way to proceed. I'm actually working with a few colleagues right now and trying to do something in that, not a major thing, but something in that regard. So I think that is it is desirable. We need to be realistic about it. The government money is the driver, even with the wonderful job that Elon Musk has done with SpaceX and the development of the Falcon rockets. Primarily, it's driven by government customers paying government contract money. So the partnership aspect is incredibly important. If he wanted to do that all along without any government contract money at all, it wouldn't have been done, of course.
Larry is in New York with an email and says, thank you for this walk through history from your perspective. Did you have any opportunities with the Planetary Society to even look at China and their program, or was it so far below the horizon that it was just not there to even be noticed?
Well, no, I did. I actually made, four trips to China, and we tried to develop some cooperative relationships with them in the early 2000s, late, I guess it was the early 2000s, that we did try to develop some cooperative relationships. We had some activities, I would say, more at the public interaction level. I gave a talk over there. They participated in some program we had with the Planetary Society here, but we never found anything that we could not find a particular thing that that they would do. I don't think the Chinese ever saw the role of us that we did on the rover testing, like we did when we did it with the Russians, as helping the American program. They didn't see it as that beneficial to them and their development of their program. And of course, at that time, they were focusing on their nascent capabilities. They hadn't really accomplished any major missions of any kind. There might be a better feeling about it there now, except now the relationships between the United States and China have gotten so negative that there's actually laws in the United States which prohibit cooperation with China, and that'll change, I'm sure, but and especially as they begin to accomplish more in space. But we made some attempt, but we didn't, and we had some relationships, but we didn't really accomplish as much as we wanted to at that time.
Beverly's in Austin with another email for you. I guess this is going to be an email morning. And she says, I remember many years ago, lots of us were very excited and staying tuned to see how the Planetary Society launch on a Soviet Dnieper missile from a submarine age was going to make it to Phobos, but unfortunately it didn't work. How hard was it from a U.S. as well as a Russian perspective to use a Dnieper missile, and what happened on that launch? Why did it fail?
Well, I could be wrong. I always worry about my memory, especially as I get older. I don't think it was a Nepr missile. I think the Phobos, first of all, the Phobos mission, I think, was launched on a Proton because it was going to Mars. So I believe that was a Proton fourth stage failure. I was actually, I was at the Mars 96 launch. I wasn't at that one. The Phobos mission launch was one on a Proton, but it then went into Earth orbit and failed on the stage that was supposed to fire it out of Earth orbit. The, Mars 96 mission Proton failure was a fourth stage on the rocket that actually sent the spacecraft into the Pacific Ocean. The mission that the Planetary Society was on was a different one altogether. It wasn't anywhere near as powerful. That was when we tried to launch the Cosmos 1 Silver Sail, and that was on a converted submarine launch ballistic missile called the Volna. And I recount quite a lot about that in the book as well. And that one failed, I think, basically because of sloppiness on the part of the industry that was both making the rocket and then making it available. It was a bad time in the Russia at that point, as many listeners probably remember. The Soviet Union was coming apart. Capabilities were deteriorating. There was a lot of things that were not working as well, and unfortunately, that was one of them. So in general, our record on Russian rockets hasn't been good, despite the overall record on Soviet rockets being good for that. But the Planetary Society experience with Russian rockets has not been good.
Did you have any insurance for the failed launches, or you're just out the money, or does Russia reimburse you?
Well, Russia doesn't reimburse us. We did have insurance on the first Cosmos 1 launch, and we did get a relaunch, basically, that was paid for, that we didn't have to pay additional money for. The launch that was, we even recovered some money that we sunk costs that we had done. The final Cosmos 1 failure, we did not have insurance on, and we did not get a launch on. Now, they did not charge us for the launch, so there was no really point in getting we lost the money that we had invested in the spacecraft, of course, but we didn't get charged for that launch at all. I remember there's an amusing story I tell in the book, which we were having in negotiations, and we're on the launch, and Russians had come to us, and they said, you have to get insurance. It's required by our government. And I said, well, okay, what's the parameters? And they laid it out, and it was going to cost us like hundreds of thousands of dollars more than the Planetary Society was even going to spend on its initial stage of the development. And I said, well, we can't afford that. And they said, well, you have to pay it. You have no choice, because if you don't pay it, the United States will be at fault. And then so the government will have to pay. And I said, well, okay, the government can pay. Well, you don't want to, they'll take over the Planetary Society. I said, okay. And that ended the negotiations. I said, if that's what happens, that's what happens. But we did not negotiate. And they, of course, were playing a game. We did not have to buy their insurance policy for that.
You have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Yes, hi. This is Bill calling from Raleigh.
Hi, Bill. Nice to hear from you again.
Hi. Good to talk to you, David. And it's great to have a chance to talk to Dr. Friedman. I have followed the progress of the Planetary Society since its very beginning days, and have always been a big advocate for the organization, primarily because my own interest in space is primarily driven by the search for life off Earth. And I feel that that's been a priority for the Planetary Society since the beginning. And I will apologize in advance if I miss this, because I've missed the first few minutes of the show, and I'll listen to it on archives if I need to. But I just wanted to ask, how do you feel about the evolution of the Society over time, and what it's doing today? Is it in keeping with the original vision as you three folks had it originally in its current progress?
Well, I can tell you that I'm delighted, and I'm sure my co-founder before, unfortunately, but Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray would also be very delighted that we created an organization that is still successful after 40 years, still booming, still interesting to people like yourself, and still carrying on the mission of advocating exploration of other worlds and the search for extraterrestrial life. So I think we're very happy and very proud. I'm very happy and very proud of what we created. It's kind of like having a baby, growing up and then having the baby become an adult, and the adult may not do exactly all the same things that I was doing or I would have done, but it doesn't matter. They're successful and they're doing a good job. And so I'm very proud of what the society is doing.
Well, that's a human enterprise for you. I guess that's great. Sounds good.
I think that's the driving reason the public is interested in space exploration. I mean, it's all interesting to look at surface features on Mars and even chemistry on other worlds and all that. But it's all related to this question of, are we alone in the universe or are we unique? And we don't know the answer to that. And that's still the driving thing that we want to know by exploring other worlds. So I think this emphasis that we've put on the whole question of search for extraterrestrial life on other worlds, in other planetary systems, I think is the driving public interest in space exploration.
Well, I would love to see that emphasis continue over time. I've been fortunate to participate in some of the Day of Action calls on legislators on Capitol Hill associated with the Planetary Society. I would certainly like to see that emphasis continue. I know that's probably not the top of mind reason for every person who's interested in advocating for space, but I think for a lot of us that is a primary driver.
Thank you.
And I will clear the line. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for your call. Good talking to you again. Listeners, Bill cleared the line, and we still have time if you also would like to give us a call, 866-687-7223. I have a sort of an off-topic area, but not off-topic to your expertise. For some strange reason, over the last 10 days, I have been contacted by people. I have no clue who they are, but they're credible people, and they have a great interest in interstellar solar sails. And you wrote a book about this called Star Sailing.
Yes.
Where are we today with using solar sails for interstellar? Now, I've done the programs with Breakthrough. You know all the people. You know, I know all the people. I've talked to physicists at UC Santa Barbara and others about interstellar flight. It's a hot topic. On the space show, they talk about laser beaming. I know you're grounded in all of this. Solar sails for interstellar flight. What do you think? Is this plausible? Is it in our future or near future?
Well, I'm on the Breakthrough Starshot Advisory Committee. I'm working on a mission now, which is not going to go interstellar, but goes out into the interstellar medium and attempts to do an imaging mission around the using the solar gravity lens way out there at 600 AU. That's a long ways, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to interstellar. Solar sails are the way to go fast out of the solar system. I think they're the best way. I think they're the only affordable way, actually, because everything else requires big engines with lots of propellant or nuclear and things that we just can't afford. So I think strongly that solar sails are the only way to get out of the gas. That said, they won't make it to interstellar. You can go through the calculations, and no matter how good a solar sail you have, even if it's made up of molecule thick material is perfectly reflective, you really don't get a practical interstellar mission out of that. Even the laser propelled solar sail that Starshot wants to use can really only accelerate a 1 gram spacecraft, gosh sakes, over that distance in any practical sense. So I'm actually, even though I think it's a great driver for these developments, I think that interstellar flight is harder than the science fiction people tend to make us believe, because they really do have solutions for it. They're just not ones that we can practically implement. And so I'm not saying it will never happen, but it will take enormous amounts of power, like the laser sail, and enormous amount of achievements in other ways, or some invention of yet hitherto unknown phenomenon that will make it possible. So I guess that's a weasel word answer of saying that I'm participating in the research on it, and I'm a great believer in interstellar precursors, but I think the ultimate way to explore other star systems is going to be remotely with such things as the solar gravity lens telescope.
Is there anything near term that can even get us to approach interstellar? I mean, you said you can't do the interstellar.
No, I don't think so. I don't think, enough time, if you're willing to wait 10,000 years, of course, Voyager's going interstellar right now. So, yes, we're doing interstellar flight right now. But if you're talking about achieving a mission within a century, within a lifetime, I don't think there's anything right now that will get us there.
There's no really exotic breakthrough propulsion that...
Well, the laser sail proposal that Phil Lubin and his colleagues at UC Santa Barbara
yeah.
worked and that Breakthrough is pursuing is the most promising, and it will, in theory, do it. But as I say, it will, in theory, do it with a 1 gram spacecraft, and it will only do it to the nearest star, not in general to interstellar destinations. So I guess in that sense, maybe that could happen within a century, but even that's a tall order. And I'm so no, I don't think there's anything in the near term, or when I say near term, I mean in the century that will achieve it.
So folks our age, I'm 74, you're a little older than I am, not going to happen for us to see it.
I think that's correct.
Not nice.
Right.
Does any of this research beckon federal research dollars, or is it too exotic, too far out there for putting federal dollars into it?
There's no real federal factors. Unfortunately, NASA is not even supportive of solar sail development, which could open up the solar system to much quicker and faster missions. We're working on them to try and convince them of that right now. And there's certainly no interstellar work. There's a very interesting mission called the Interstellar Probe, which is being worked on as a proposal for a launch in about 2030. But it's called the Interstellar Probe, but its really destination is 200 or 300 AU, just maybe twice as far as Voyager has achieved.
Too bad. And nothing from any other countries changes your perspective?
Well, China's actually talked about doing a mission that would basically replicate the Voyager mission. I don't know if they're really going to do it or not. I read an article that said they were going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Revolution, which was in 1948. By 2048, they hoped to get out to the interstellar medium with a 100 AU destination or something of that sort. But that's the only one I've heard of who's going even that far. And, of course, that's not interstellar by any definition.
You never worked on anything even came close during your Planetary Society days, did you?
In fact, we sponsored a conference on interstellar propulsion and it was called Practical Interstellar Flight. And as I say, there's lots of ideas out there, but they're all theoretical, and I came away. And again, this is my personal opinion. I could be wrong. I've been wrong once or twice in my life before. So I don't know. I'm just saying that my opinion, we have not come up with the practical way to do interstellar flight.
Well, I
touch on this a little bit in the book. It's actually more in the previous book that I was talking. The previous book, which was Human Spaceflight from Mars to the Stars, was actually driven by this realization that we were working on these interstellar ideas, and I didn't think we were going to make it, and I was basically then concluding that the future of human spaceflight is not going to be with humans. It's going to be with artificial intelligence and advanced robotics, where we project ourselves and virtually explore other worlds as opposed to going to them. Now, that some people consider that negative. I know many space enthusiasts think that that humans won't get to the stars is kind of a negative conclusion. I actually don't. I think that if humans are exploring the stars and extrasolar planets, and they're getting all that data, and they're doing all the things, but they're doing them in virtual and artificial worlds, we're doing a lot of that now, and I think that will be... We'll learn more, we'll learn it faster, and it'll be just as exciting. So I don't consider it a negative conclusion.
Okay, and so the actual book title for that one is Human Spaceflight.
Human Spaceflight from Mars to the Stars.
Okay.
And so if people can go to my website, www.lewisdfriedman.com, or they can go to Amazon and find and just put my name in, and any one of the books will pop up. Well, people have my name, so it might be different books, but I know that all three books are listed on Amazon.
On your website, or can they get autographed copies?
No, the Planetary Society is going to do a virtual book signing in September. And so those of your listeners who are members of the Society or want to connect with the Society, they can find out about that. But I know on one of the Saturdays in September, we're going to do a virtual book signing in which we're making arrangements for me to sign some books and also to have some personalization in them as well.
So listeners, check that out at the Planetary Society if you're interested in an autographed book for Lou. What was the most challenging experience working with the Soviet Union and later Russia on space projects for the Planetary Society?
Well, I think at first it was just being able to meaningfully interact, and it was some very difficult missions in there that we talk about: the rover testing on the Tabachik volcano in Kamchatka, the rover testing arrangements that we had to make, some of the earliest days of bringing computers into the Soviet Union, and finding NASA resistance to the fact that we were setting up cooperative links that they were not in charge of. They were sort of administrative difficulties. Technically, the big challengers were those that always face spaceflight: having a working spacecraft and having working rockets that can accomplish their missions. And in that sense, I do very much appreciate the wonderful scientists and engineers who I got to work with in the United States and the Soviet Union, later Russia, in Europe. Many of them are mentioned in the book, because they all had a common purpose, and they did it without there's a lot of national background to everybody, but they did it without in an internationally cooperative spirit, and that's the way I think we accomplish more.
On your website, and if people click about the book, you have part of your conclusion there, and you urge a refocus on international cooperation, including China and all spacefaring nations. Is that happening? Are we struggling at doing
happening.
That?
I don't want to get into politics on your
right.
show, I'm sure, but it's no secret that the United States has basically shrunk its international objectives. They pulled out of most treaties, whether they're military or civilian, whether they're trade or whether they're environmental. The United States has become much more negative about international cooperation in the last few years. I know that will change. I've seen that before. I know that will change. I hope it changes sooner rather than later, because I think it's also dangerous. But on the other hand, this is not the... I think international cooperation, if you're young, is a great field to go into, because there will be a resurgence, but it's not a field that people working in right now are getting any pleasure out of.
What about in space? Is it any different than the general description you gave?
Well, yes. The space station is remarkable. Even in the harshest days of of Russian-American relationships right now. Our space station agreement is not in danger. We do help each other a lot. And so there is general cooperation. And Europe is now working on the Mars sample return program with NASA. And so space has generally been free of the day-to-day political environments. They're affected by them, of course. But no, in space, I think things are much better.
I have one more question that may be the last question of the day, and it is from Jimmy in Atlanta. And Jimmy's a little kind of off the topic that we've been talking about a little bit. And he says, in terms of the commercial space, the moon, Mars, and things that are happening with the different large rocket companies and little rocket companies, aren't we really in a position to turn over, say, cislunar space to the private sector? I hear this all the time. The domain for the private sector should be cislunar, which would be anything from the Earth to the Moon. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm pretty sure that if we turn it over to the private sector, nothing will get done. Because before you turn it over to the private sector, you have to know what the commercial return is. And we're a long way from that. A lot of work to be done. So if we are going to develop commercial ideas, whether they're on the moon or on asteroids or in cislunar space generally, there needs to be a government program that's going to do that exploration, conduct the science, develop the capabilities. I think there are things that ultimately can get done. I'm working with a company now that has a very good possibility of doing a privately funded lunar orbiter mission, but it would be in combination with and support for government programs. So public-private partnerships, I think, are good, but the idea of turning it over to the private sector, I think, is just a way to end the program.
We didn't talk about it, but you probably came across space settlement while you were with the Planetary Society and with Dr. O'Neill, maybe. Any commentary you'd like to offer us before we sign off on space settlement, and how does that work with human space flight and what we've been talking about?
I know that Carl Sagan and I discussed that many times. We were sort of skeptical or cautionary about it, that it was a leap too far to know how that would turn out before we even had the idea of knowing what was on those other worlds for space settlement or how to construct them or what humans would do there if they got there. So a little bit like asking the 15th century European explorers, what do you think of the urban planning in cities in North America? We weren't there yet in that. I think we need to find out what's out there, how humans can adapt. I'm not sure even the sustainability of a human base on Mars. I have ideas about how it might be accomplished, but how that will turn out. You know, we haven't settled the Antarctic. We visit the Antarctic. We conduct experiments down there. Then we bring the people home and we do other experiments and other visits. So, and we certainly haven't done anything like that underwater, under the oceans, which is a much more benign environment, has many more resources, much easier to get to than sort of doing it in space or in other worlds. So we have a lot to learn before we can, I think, have an opinion on space settlements.
Even going to the moon, I mean, that's another common one where we should be building settlements on the moon right now.
Well, I think that's a bridge too far. I'm not even sure that human sustainability on the moon is going to work out for a base. Now, you know, maybe we will, maybe it will, but the moon is very hostile. It's dry, it's airless, it's cold, and so as I say, compared to Antarctica or compared to under the oceans, we haven't settled those areas yet either.
What have we missed in our program today that you wanted to talk about, especially with your book? Have we forgotten something or omitted something?
No, we really covered quite a lot. I guess I will say that the title of the book, the word adventures in the title, also conveys that I got a, there was a lot of personal adventures, you know, interactions, stories that of things we did with scientists. We did a balloon flight in Lithuania, and we interacted with the local population trying to explain to them about Mars balloons and ideas like that. There's a lot of stories in the book that truly come under the definition of personal adventures. They're not, I don't know that they're great history activities in the course of the space program, but I do want to convey the idea that there's very gratifying to participate in so many adventures on Earth as a result of my interest in space exploration.
Well, we're very glad you shared it with us, and listeners, if you get the book, and I hope you do get it, you will really have a great read. And Lou, what's next? Do you have another one on the horizon?
I don't know. I think I may be tapped out in the book business. I'm working on these couple of mission ideas, but I'm not. I may be tapped out. Writing is not my number one profession.
Well, the writing you've done has been great, and having read your books, and I really appreciated them. I think the world and the space advocacy world is a lot richer for it. So thank you very much for that. And listeners, that's going to be it for our program with Dr. Friedman today. So we hope everybody has a great, safe rest of the weekend. Lou, I will archive this and get it to you via online archives just as soon as possible, either later today or early tomorrow morning. And I hope we get a chance to see one another at a real conference someday again.
Hope we get a chance to see anybody again in your future, right? Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And God bless and stay safe and well. And I hope
you
we
too.
Get to talk to you again down the road.
Thank you.
Listeners,
thank
that's it.
Much.
So goodbye from Lou, David, and the Space Show. Remember, everyone, keep looking up.